The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Welcome. I'm Deborah Love for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues, bringing you information from respected sources about health matters that may be helpful for you or those you care about in consultation with your health care provider. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic newsletter. And this first article is really very topical. It seems everywhere we look today, we're being urged to up our protein intake. You know, it's mainstream when they're promoting it at that coffee shop with the big green mermaid. So here's the scoop on protein powders. Sorry, just couldn't resist that little pun. Protein powder is not just for bodybuilders and athletes. Protein is an essential nutrient that can help anyone maintain the muscles needed for an active life. Despite the body's basic need for protein, almost half of people over age 70 don't get the amount recommended to help prevent age-related loss of muscle mass, known as sarcopenia. The recommended daily dose of protein for people 65 and older is at least 1.2 grams of protein for each kilogram of body weight. So someone who weighs about 160 pounds, which equates to 73 kilograms, would need to consume roughly 87 grams of protein a day. This may seem like a lot. It may be more than you're used to eating, especially if you're eating fewer animal-based foods or you simply don't have the appetite you once did. For some, dental issues or trouble swallowing may prevent being able to consume protein-rich foods such as meats or hard-boiled eggs. Another option for getting more protein in your diet is to supplement with protein powders. These powders usually have 20 to 25 grams of protein in a serving. Spacing out the servings over breakfast, lunch, and dinner can offer a convenient and time-efficient option for meeting your daily protein goal. However, with protein powders, there can be confusion about which one to select or whether or not they are safe. So let's look at label breakdown. When shopping for protein powder supplements, look for 100% protein product with a list of ingredients that includes the 9 essential amino acids: histidine, isoleucine, leucine, lysine, methionine, phenylalanine, threonine, tryptophan, and valine. Avoid products such as mass gainers or sports performance blends. These can contain significant amounts of added sugars or calories that may not be beneficial for the general population. Also, be mindful that some powders use artificial sweeteners such as erythritol and sorbitol, which can cause bloating, gas, and other digestive issues. Don't count collagen powder as a good protein source. While there is some evidence that collagen can help support joints, collagen powder lacks the essential amino acids that help with muscle protein synthesis and prevention of sarcopenia. Some protein powders come in an unsweetened flavor, making them versatile for adding to your favorite breakfast smoothie, oatmeal, or even water. Protein powders are made from various sources, including soy, hemp, whey, peas, eggs, and brown rice. Whey, pea, soy, and egg protein powders provide high-quality protein that is easily digestible and can promote muscle recovery and maintenance of muscle over time. Egg whites are used to produce egg-based protein powder, while they and casein are the main proteins in dairy-based protein powder. This makes both animal-based products, powders from soy, hemp, pea, and rice are all made from plants and can offer vegetarian-friendly versions. Research has shown that there can be nutritional differences in the quality and therefore physical benefits among different protein sources. Plant-based sources of protein powder may require people to consume roughly 20% more total protein to compensate for the very low levels of key amino acids. Older adults can get benefits from plant-based proteins, but they may need to eat higher amounts of these proteins daily. Unfortunately, there are some reasons for concern about protein powders. According to research, nearly 14% of protein powder supplements tested positive for heavy metals such as arsenic and cadmium. Plant-based protein powders tend to have a higher risk of these metals. This is why it's critical to buy products that have been tested and carry a seal of approval from third-party testing organizations such as U.S. Pharmacopoeia, known as USP, Banned Substances Control Group, known as BSCG, Informed Sport, or NSF. Powders that are marketed for weight loss or weight gain can include non-protein ingredients that add calories, such as fats and fillers. Depending on your needs and physical activity level, you may not want a high-calorie protein powder. Those trying to lose weight, specifically body fat, may require a slightly higher daily protein intake to prevent also losing muscle. A daily intake of 1.6 grams per kilogram of body weight can help minimize muscle loss. Additionally, protein can help curb hunger cravings during a weight loss phase and help with appetite control. Moderate to high protein intakes, that's 1.2 to 1.8 grams per kilogram a day, are safe without negative effects on kidneys or bones. So let's take a look at some tips from a Mayo Clinic dietitian. You have protein powder in your pantry, so now what? Consider adding it to your diet in numerous ways. You could mix a scoop into hot oatmeal with milk and berries, or add to overnight oats with banana or a little chocolate. You could build it into a smoothie, no matter if you're into tropical, veggie-filled, or something that resembles a milkshake. Smoothies are one of the best ways to pump up the protein. They also mask the texture if you're sensitive to it. Add a small scoop to your favorite yogurt. Top with fruit, nuts, or seeds to make it resemble a meal. Or you can switch it out, your favorite coffee creamer, for protein powder mixed with milk. Our next article from the Mayo Clinic newsletter is about managing end-stage kidney disease and treatments and advancements in doing so. End-stage renal disease, also known as end-stage kidney disease or kidney failure, is the fifth and final stage of chronic kidney disease. Chronic kidney disease is reduced kidney function, most commonly caused by diabetes and uncontrolled high blood pressure. Recent treatment advances have greatly enhanced both quality of life and flexibility for people with end-stage renal disease. The kidneys filter excess fluid and waste from the body. Out of the 30 to 50 gallons of blood that flow through the kidneys daily, about 1 to 2 quarts of excess fluids and waste are eliminated in the urine. In addition to filtering blood, the kidneys produce hormones that help regulate blood pressure, set the body's calcium levels, and make red blood cells that transport oxygen throughout the body. When the kidneys lose their ability to filter wastes and fluids build up. You may not notice early chronic kidney disease, but symptoms of end-stage renal disease include nausea, vomiting, weakness, changes in urination, swelling, chest pain, headaches, cramping, and a metallic taste in the mouth. At that point, you'll likely need to replace kidney function through either dialysis or kidney transplant. So let's look at dialysis first. Dialysis helps perform the filtering functions of your kidneys when they are no longer able to do so on their own. There are two main types of dialysis, hemodialysis and peritoneal dialysis. Both can be done in a hospital, at a dialysis center, or at home, depending on your situation. First is hemodialysis. It's the most common type of dialysis in the U.S. During hemodialysis, a dialysis machine is connected to veins in your arm to filter wastes, reduce excess fluid, and balance electrolytes in your blood. In-center, hemodialysis is usually required 3 times a week for 3 to 5 hours each session. Home dialysis may be an option. Two important factors for doing that home hemodialysis at home are having a health center that supports connected technology and having someone to help you. Home dialysis is usually done in shorter, more frequent sessions, 4 to 6 days a week for 2 to 4 hours at a time. Simplified machines with better device usability, including intuitive touchscreen interfaces and step-by-step instructions, have made home dialysis easier and less intimidating to learn. Home dialysis has been linked to increased well-being, better sleep, fewer headaches, and less nausea. It also is linked to better cardiovascular health, bone health, and fluid management. Whether at home or in a center, you can nap, read, watch TV, or sometimes even sleep at night when having hemodialysis. Your healthcare team monitors your treatment with regular blood tests to check that the dialysis is removing enough waste and keeping chemistries balanced. One of the most impactful changes over the past decade has been the ability to transmit treatment data in real time to a healthcare team. This reduces the burden on you and allows your healthcare team to identify potential issues quickly. Following a certain diet helps ensure dialysis success. You may be referred to a registered dietitian. A diet that's easier on your kidneys may limit sodium, potassium, and phosphorus since your kidneys can no longer optimally balance the minerals in your blood. While it's important to get enough protein while on dialysis, too much protein can cause the buildup of waste products. Your healthcare team can help determine what amount of protein is right for you based on your size and overall health. Now let's look at peritoneal dialysis. In peritoneal dialysis, a catheter tube inserted into the abdomen delivers cleansing fluid into the abdominal cavity. The fluid absorbs blood waste through the peritoneum, the natural membrane that lines the cavity. From there, the fluid flows out and is discarded. This cycle repeats several times each session. This dialysis can be done at home by yourself, with some skilled effort, or with caregiver support. Cycles usually are done overnight using an automated machine, or they can be done manually several times throughout the day. A benefit of peritoneal dialysis compared with hemodialysis is more flexibility. It can be done at work, while traveling, or at home, even if you live far from a health center. It also is a better option if you struggle with needles or some of the side effects of hemodialysis, and it's generally more cost-effective. Now we'll consider transplant pathways. The kidney is the most commonly transplanted organ, and 85% of people on the U.S. transplant waiting list need one. Only one donated kidney is needed to replace 2 failed kidneys. A preemptive kidney transplant is a kidney transplant that occurs before dialysis begins. This is considered the best option for end-stage renal disease. However, only 2.5% of all kidney transplants in the U.S. are preemptive. Most kidney transplants are done in people who are on dialysis. After a successful kidney transplant, you should no longer need dialysis. Compared with dialysis, a transplant can provide you with a better quality of life, lower risk of premature death, and fewer dietary restrictions. However, advanced age, dementia, severe heart disease, recently treated or current cancer, obesity, and other factors may prevent you from being eligible to safely undergo the procedure. Some forms of kidney disease may recur after a transplant, or the body may reject the donor organ. Following post-transplant care instructions and taking anti-rejection medicine that can increase your chances of a successful transplant. Transplanting organs from other species, primarily pigs, is showing promise in the near future. This is known as xenotransplantation. In February 2025, the Food and Drug Administration granted approval to two companies to conduct clinical trials in humans using genetically modified pig kidneys. Artificial kidney development also is progressing. While not yet ready for widespread use, new technology could become a viable option for kidney replacement in the coming years. Now, while we're on the subject of diabetes, let's talk about how you can protect your feet from diabetes complications. Diabetes can damage nerves and reduce blood flow to your feet, causing pain, numbness, or a sore that doesn't heal. The best ways to protect your feet from serious conditions are good blood sugar management and a foot care routine that you can follow each day. This routine looks like this. 1. Watch how you wash. Use warm water, no hotter than 95 degrees Fahrenheit, a soft cloth, and soap. Wash your feet in and between your toes. If you soak your feet, be careful as it can dry out your skin. After washing, pat dry with a clean towel. 2. Check for potential problems. Look for cuts, sores, skin color changes, blisters, ingrown toenails, corns, calluses, and plantar warts. Make note of any warm spots on your skin which could be signs of infection. If you can't see the bottoms of your feet, use a mirror or ask someone to help. You might even take pictures of your soles with a cell phone, which can allow you to zoom in to identify problems. 3. Add moisture. Rub a light coat of lotion or petroleum jelly on the tops and bottoms of your feet, but avoid applying between your toes, where added moisture can encourage growth of fungus or bacteria. After moisturizing, put on socks or slippers to prevent slips. 4. Keep nails straight and smooth. When needed, trim straight across with toenail clippers after you wash and dry your feet. Gently smooth each nail with an emery board or nail file. Safe nail care can prevent ingrown toenails and other wounds from forming. 5. Never go barefoot. Wear clean socks and shoes or slippers that fit well, even when you're indoors. Shake out your shoes after wearing them to make sure that you're free of pebbles. Routinely look at the inside lining of your shoes for signs of wear and replace your shoes when needed. When you buy new shoes, try to stick to styles that with plenty of room for your toes, such as walking or athletic shoes. Lastly, keep the blood flowing. Throughout the day, wiggle your toes and move your ankles up and down and in circles. When sitting, put your feet up. It also helps to get regular exercise and not smoke. Tell your healthcare team if you have any foot injury or swelling that isn't healing, skin that's warm or has changed colors, or patches of thick skin on your feet. Also mention if you're having trouble with daily care. Your team may be able to help provide helpful resources. There seems to be a lot of controversy today about vaccines, but the Mayo Clinic is unequivocal in its recommendation of one vaccine, the one for RSV. They say, get the RSV vaccine. It works. When a new vaccine is developed, there's often skepticism. This was true for the respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, vaccine that was approved for older adults in 2023. But research done over the first 2 years has been overwhelmingly positive. A 2024 study in Lancet looked at data from the first season of the vaccine. Researchers found it was 80% effective in reducing RSV-associated hospitalizations and 77% effective against RSV-associated emergency department visits in adults age 60 and older with healthy immune systems. For those with weakened immune systems, the effectiveness against RSV hospitalization was still high at 73%. New data from JAMA Network Open showed similar results, finding vaccine effectiveness of about 75% against acute respiratory infection, urgent care or emergency visits, and hospitalizations in people with healthy immune systems. The rates were lower but still significant in those with weakened immune systems. The New England Journal of Medicine published positive results for the vaccine's continued effectiveness. Although somewhat lower than in the initial year, the vaccine maintained almost 78% effectiveness against more severe RSV illness in its second season. Before the vaccine, RSV caused an estimated 5.2 million respiratory infections, 470,000 hospitalizations, and 33,000 in-hospital deaths among older adults a year in high-income countries such as the U.S. Mayo Clinic experts encourage older adults who haven't already received an RSV vaccine to ask about it at upcoming healthcare visits. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that everyone age 75 and older receive a one-time RSV vaccine. It's also recommended for adults ages 50 to 74 who are at increased risk of severe RSV. This includes adults with weakened immune system, those with chronic heart or lung disease, and those who live in long-term care facilities. Well, that's a pretty resounding majority of data to show the effectiveness of this particular vaccine. This next article was surprising to me. It's entitled, ED Drugs May Protect the Heart and Brain. Tadalafil, known as Cialis, and Sildenafil, known as Viagra, are the best known for treating erectile dysfunction, or ED. They're also prescribed for urinary symptoms linked to an enlarged prostate. But these drugs may offer more than symptom relief. They also may lower the risk of serious conditions such as heart attack, stroke, and dementia. Tadalafil and sildenafil are PDE5 inhibitors. They boost levels of cGMP, a molecule that increases smooth muscle relaxation. This allows blood vessels to relax and improves a blood flow while also reducing oxidative stress and inflammation. Because the drugs can cross into the brain, research suggests they may support cognitive function. The potential benefits were recently highlighted in a large study of more than 1.6 million men over age 40 with ED or urinary symptoms. The study published in the American Journal of Medicine found that men taking tadalafil or sildenafil may experience additional health benefits. Men who took either drug had lower risks of stroke, dementia, heart attack, blood clots, and death from any cause over a span of 3 years compared with men not taking the drugs. The risk reductions were greater for men taking tadalafil, especially for those taking the drug daily to relieve urinary symptoms. But men who took either drug only as needed for ED still appeared to have a significantly reduced risk. The results are encouraging, but don't prove that the medications directly cause these effects. More research is needed. Still, if you're a candidate for one of these drugs, discuss the potential broader benefits with your healthcare team. And remember, lifestyle factors such as regular physical activity, a healthy diet, and good sleep remain the pillars of heart and brain health. And our final article for today reminds us that mindfulness may be similar to medication in treating anxiety. Practicing mindfulness has long been appreciated as a healthy way to improve mood and reduce stress. A recent study suggests that it can be more. an alternative therapy for people with anxiety disorders that delivers similar relief from symptoms with fewer side effects. The study, published in JAMA Psychiatry, involved 276 adults who had one of the following conditions: fear or avoidance of places that may cause feelings of being trapped or embarrassed, known as agoraphobia, panic disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, or social anxiety disorder. Participants were divided into two groups, with one group taking escitalopram, known as Lexapro, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor or an SSRI drug commonly used for anxiety. The other group was taught to practice mindfulness meditation, a type of daily mindfulness, but was not given the medication. After 8 weeks, the group scored similarly in a measure of reduced anxiety symptoms, with people taking escitalopram showing a small edge in symptom improvement. Where the groups clearly differed significantly was in side effects. About 79% of the people taking escitalopram reported having at least one side effect potentially related to the treatment, including sleep problems, nausea, fatigue, or headache. In contrast, the only side effect reported in the mindfulness group at 15% was increased anxiety. Meditation is a type of mind-body medicine. Meditation can help you relax deeply and calm your mind using a variety of exercises. During meditation, you learn to observe your thoughts without judgment, while focusing the mind on a task such as breathing. With greater awareness of the wandering mind, you become more able to observe and allow negative or worrying thoughts to just come and go. This prevents you from getting stuck in those thoughts that crowd your mind and cause stress. Mayo Clinic experts say the study provides some more evidence to support mindfulness as an effective approach. But larger studies that look at longer-term outcomes are needed. Talk with your healthcare team about your treatment strategies and find out which are best for your mental health concerns. Well, sadly, we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Deborah Love, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. I'd really love to hear from you. Are there topics you'd like to hear more about? Is there information you found particularly helpful? Or just let me know you're listening. That number again is 919-832-5138. As always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.